1.4 million cars after revelations that a Jeep can be remotely taken over through its radio software. But if cars are a problem, what about whole cities, which have these increasingly automated computer-generated systems managing things? We recommend that you read the New Scientist August 8th issue article titled How to Take Out a City. Because we make these recommendations all the time, and we hope at least some of you do these things. But the piece by Sam Wong points out that cities are getting ever more sophisticated, automated, and, quote, smart, unquote. But this only increases their vulnerability to hacking. The picture accompanying the piece showed New York City with various labels of things that might be hacked, like air traffic control, sensor-activated streetlights, electric road signs, toll-collecting systems, elevators, municipal surveillance, gas stations, hospitals, water supply, sewage systems, power stations. We're going to continue to keep an eye on this topic, just not today, because we're out of time. At any rate, our thanks to Cosmo Garvin. We trust we have not heard the last from that fine reporter. This program was produced by Edward McMillan. You've been listening to Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett, and we will see you next week at the same time.
Oh, let the sun beat down upon my face. Stars to fill my dream. I'm a traveler of both time and space. To be where I have been.
From the KPFK studios in Southern California,
it's the Ralph Nader Radio Hour.
Stand up, stand up. You've been sitting way too long.
Welcome to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. My name is Steve Scrovan, along with my trusty co-host, David Feldman, and of course the main man, the man of the hour, Ralph Nader. On the show today, we will be talking to journalist Alyssa Katz of the New York Daily News about her recent book. It's called The Influence Machine, The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Corporate Capture of American Life. We will also be hearing from corporate crime reporter Russell McKiber on our new regular feature, The Corporate Crime Reporter Minute. But before we do all of that, we're going to talk about the high price of prescription drugs and also their effectiveness. David, introduce our first guest.
Dr. Sidney Wolfe is making a second appearance on our show. He is the prime author of Worst Pills, Best Pills. It's a guide to the safety and effectiveness of pharmaceuticals. Dr. Sidney Wolfe is one of Ralph's longest and closest colleagues and one of the founders of Public Citizen. For over 40 years, he was the director of the health research group at Public Citizen, which to date has been responsible for getting 24 dangerous drugs off the market. Dr. Sidney Wolfe has been a tireless watchdog responsible not only for that, but for policing the medical device industry, dangerous toys, appliances, and other consumer products. Most recently, he is the co-author of a report that has come out of Public Citizen entitled Mirror, Mirror on the Wall. It's about how the Medicare Part D program pays needlessly high prices for name brand drugs. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Sidney Wolfe.
Nice to be here once again.
Nice to be with you on the program, Sid. When I co-founded the Public Citizen Health Research Group with Dr. Sidney Wolfe in 1971, he declared that this was his last job, and it has. He's still on the job. The drug industry might have been advised to quiver when they heard that, because his Worst Pills, Best Pills books, newsletters, and spectacular outreach via the Phil Donahue Show to millions of Americans, he's exposed by brand names. He names drugs, hundreds of drugs with harmful side effects. Those are the worst pills compared to drugs without such an unfavorable risk-benefit profile. Those are the best pills. In the 1970s, he and his associates successfully advocated that many totally useless prescription and over-the-counter drugs be taken off the market. And eventually, they were saving patients also billions of dollars.
That was a book called Pills That Don't Work. They actually didn't work at all. The government knew it, and they hadn't really done what they should have, taken off the market, since the law said you can't have drugs that don't work on the market.
Sid, since over 80% of the American people take medicines of one kind or another. This is going to be a pretty gripping presentation by you. Why don't you start with what you found, what you predicted in terms of drugs, and just elaborate what happens when people take FDA-approved drugs and the side effects end up with nausea, gastrointestinal bleeding, falls, broken hips. Why don't you present your thesis for the last 40-plus years, worst pills, best pills?
I think the thesis is not very complicated. Why should anyone take a drug that has risks that exceed the benefits? Whether it's the process of putting a drug on the market, if you know before a drug is on the market that it has risks that really aren't matched by the benefits, it shouldn't be approved. And we have tried sometimes successfully to stop drugs even before they come in the market. More often, unfortunately, though, even though there's evidence before approval that they have risks that are greater than the benefits, it takes the literal experimentation on millions of people after the drug is approved to confirm that. And so many times we have asked the FDA in the 43 years since you and I started this group, we asked the FDA to ban 38 drugs. It's actually 25 now, not 24 that are taken off the market. So two-thirds of the drugs that we asked them to ban, based in some cases on evidence before they were approved, and in other cases on evidence in addition after people were injured or killed after they were approved, two-thirds are off the market. Another quarter of them are on the market, but in very limited use compared with what they were. And a smaller number, a little over a tenth, are still on the market. And we continue to say people shouldn't use them. But I think so the idea, if this is true, we have taken action against the FDA to ban these drugs, most of the time successfully. But at the same time, because the FDA takes longer than it should to do its job to enforce the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and protect the American public, we warn people. And that's the idea that was behind Worst Pills, Best Pills. The first edition came out in 1988, and we've had several successive editions. The new edition is being worked on now. It'll probably not be out for a couple of years. But in the meantime, we have a website that has a lot of information, including information since the last time the book came out, which was 10 years ago. It's called worstpills.org. And I'd just like to go through some of the drugs and say when we told people to stop using them, and then later, often much later, when they were taken off the market.
Listeners, please listen to this carefully, because you're going to either see that it affects you or someone who you know is a relative, neighbor, friend, or coworker. Go ahead, Sid.
And I would add that the ones I'm going to talk about are now off the market, but many people who are listening will know that while they were on the market, they may have taken them or known someone that took them and got hospitalized or killed. But I just want to tell you how long often before a drug is actually taken off the market, not infrequently because we ask the FDA to do it, do we warn people? So Darvon, one of the biggest selling drugs for 50 years, millions and millions of people took it. Thousands of people were killed, often unintentionally. Older people don't get rid of the drug as quickly, and a lot of them had heart arrhythmias and died. We originally warned people in our newsletter and in the book in 1988. We had petitioned the FDA to ban it in 1978. It was not taken off the market until 2010. But it was taken off the market 22 years after we told people, don't use it. It's not very effective, and it can kill people with heart problems.
How many did it kill, you think? You gave an estimate at the time. This was a pain reliever.
It's hard to say. Just in this country, thousands of people, and it's a very ineffective pain reliever. So I'll just go through some other ones. More recent example is a widely used drug for losing weight called Meridia. Before the drug was approved, the doctor at the FDA who reviewed it said it's too dangerous. It causes increased heart rate. It causes increased blood pressure. Don't approve it. The FDA overruled that person. He just died recently of cancer, sadly. We warned people not to take it in 1998. Only 12 years later was it taken off the market. A couple other examples, a diabetes drug called Rezulin. There was evidence before it was approved that it caused liver damage. We warned people several years before it actually came off the market. So there are a number of these drugs. I mentioned also, though, that although most of the drugs, two-thirds that we asked the FDA to ban, are off the market, there are another five that are still widely used. And let's go through those because some of you may be taking them. One is a very widely used cholesterol-lowering drug called Crestor. It was the number one selling brand name cholesterol drug in the last couple of years. Lowering your cholesterol, particularly if you have a heart attack or stroke, is very important. If you have lots of risk factors, it may also be important to prevent a first heart attack. Of all the leading drugs on the market for lowering cholesterol, Crestor is the least effective and the most dangerous. It actually causes diabetes more commonly than the other cholesterol-lowering drugs. So we asked the FDA to ban it 11 years ago, and there are warnings on it and so forth, but it's still widely used. It's going to come off patent next year, and hopefully people will stop using it because the company that makes it, AstraZeneca, has promoted it to the point where billions of dollars are sold. Another wow. very widely prescribed drug is called Celebrex. It's a so-called painkiller, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. It should have been taken off the market. We asked the FDA to take it off the market, again, more than 10 years ago. It's still widely used. It has no advantages over any other painkillers, and it does increase the risk more than the other ones of heart problems. Another example of a drug that's on the market but less widely used, we petitioned to ban it also, is the at one time extremely widely used diabetes drug called Avandia. We asked the FDA to ban it. Internal FDA documents said that the safety people in the FDA thought it should be banned. It was taken off the market all over Europe, but it's still on the market here in limited use. But if you or someone you know is one of the limited users, just stop taking it. It causes heart failure and other serious problems. So these are just some examples of drugs that we asked to be taken off the market in some cases, but a larger number of drugs that we said, don't use them because the risks outweigh the benefits. We don't study or haven't really looked that much into cancer drugs because if they work, the benefit may well outweigh the risk. But drugs for diabetes, drugs for losing weight, drugs for high blood pressure, and drugs of these kinds too often have risks that outweigh the benefits. The FDA, very few people know, is largely funded directly in cash from the drug industry through a 1992 law that should never have passed called the Prescription Drug User Fees, a sort of benign sounding. Anytime a drug company wants to get a drug approved, they have to submit an application. They've always had to do that. But they also have to send in several hundred thousand dollars. The agency gets the money whether the drug gets approved. But guess what? Since this started in 1992, the rate of dangerous drugs coming off the market has increased. The rate of drugs needing new black box warnings has increased. So the FDA is paying a lot of attention to the probably over $800 million this year going directly in cash payments from the drug industry to the FDA. If anyone thinks that has no influence on the FDA, they're wrong. We actually surveyed lots of doctors in the FDA a few years after this law passed, and it was clear to them that the standards for drug approval were being lowered, that they were being told to shut up at advisory committee meetings, that drugs such as the one I mentioned, Meridia, the weight reduction drug, that the doctors and the FDA said, don't approve it, it's too dangerous, they were approved over their head. So the FDA, I would say in the last 20 plus years, particularly even worse the last 10 years, is worse than any time in the 43 years since I left my job at the National Institutes of Health, where I was taking care of patients and doing research, to start this group.
Listeners should know that I have never met anybody in the consumer safety movement who's made more factual criticisms and has been so accurate. Super accurate. The drug companies hover over the health research group in SIDS Works, looking, searching, desperately wanting to catch him, and they can't because he's too accurate. So let me ask you this, Sid. There are about 14,000 street homicides a year in this country. How many people do you think the drug industry kills on the average? And don't they pay any price for this? Because they often know that these drugs are killing people, and they don't take them off the market unless you or maybe later the FDA or a lawsuit forces them to do so. So 14,000 homicides on the street, preventable, we would like to believe. What about how many die in this country on the average from bad side effects of drugs or wrongfully prescribed drugs that shouldn't be on the market?
Well, I mean, the estimates, which really haven't changed that much, they have gone up slightly, are around 100,000 people a year die from adverse drug reactions. Now,
that's 2,000 a week.
The FDA should be doing a better job. They aren't. The companies should be doing a better job, but they're making so much money. It is by far the most profitable large industry in the country, and it has been for 30 or 40 years. We have a database now of criminal and civil penalties paid by the drug industry. We've been doing this now for a few years, and at one time the defense industry was were the biggest crooks in the country. There was a law passed during the Civil War that said if you cheat the government and overcharge, we're going to go after you. It's called the False Claims Act. And the Defense Department, until about 10 years ago, led all industries. The drug industry is now number one, and they have paid tens of billions of dollars in civil and criminal penalties to the industry. Now, along the lines of what kind of evil doing there is, and evil is the only way of describing it, one of the more common kinds of penalties they pay are for illegally pretending the drug works for something it doesn't. It's called off-label promotion. So if a company is not selling enough drug, they'll have their salespeople go around and tell doctors, you know, it's only approved for disease A, but let me tell you about disease B and disease C. It also works for that. That's illegal. But obviously, it sells more drugs. A very widely used drug, Neurontin, at one point, 90% of the prescriptions were for diseases for which the drug hadn't been approved. The company eventually paid hundreds of millions of dollars in penalties for this, but only after lots of people used the drug under false pretenses. Another smaller category, equally awful, is failing to tell the government about dangers that the company knows about. The same drug, Avandia, the diabetes drug that's banned all over Europe, that's still used in a small way in this country, the company paid a couple $100 million in penalties because they neglected to tell the FDA some of the dangers of the drug as they, the company, were learning it. So this is an industry that's very successful. It's an industry that has done some very good things. And the question is, why can it limit what it's doing to drugs that have benefits that outweigh the risks instead of drugs that do much more harm than good? In addition to the 100,000 or so deaths a year, there are hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations preventable if people hadn't been given these drugs that it was known in advance had risks that outweigh the benefits. No one who is intent on staying alive, vigorous, loves life, would take a drug if someone told them the risks of this drug outweigh the benefits. Do you want to take it? In fact, one of the latest capers by the FDA, encouraged by the drug industry, is to put out a guidance. It was put out about 14 months ago, and it says the following. If it sounds crazy, it is, but this is what it says. It says to the drug industry, we will not object if your salespeople go into doctors' offices and tell the doctors that the drug is safer than it is. Safer being what the FDA and the company have agreed upon is the labeling about the dangers. Worse than that, though, when the drug salesperson goes into the doctor's office and hands out an article saying, you know, you thought this drug was more dangerous. Here's an article funded by us, of course, in most cases, that says it's safer. And by the way, the FDA has never seen this article. The drug salesperson has to tell the FDA, to the doctor that they're visiting, that the FDA has never seen the article. This is how far the FDA is going to try and appease the drug industry. So it's not a pretty picture again.
And here's the good news, listeners. Here's how you can avoid these bad side effect drugs that have been approved by the FDA and use drugs that have far fewer side effects. Worst pills, best pills. Here's how you can do it. From the most accurate database on this in the world. Sid, tell them how they can protect themselves, their families, neighbors, and coworkers.
Well, all of this information I talked about is on our website, a year subscription is very little. And we also warn people, it's a monthly publication, and we try and keep people up to date with the latest problems that we found with drugs. We also always mention, this is what you shouldn't be taking, but here is what you should be taking, the safer, more effective drug. In addition, we send emails out to people in between issues of the publication, Worst Pills, Best Pills News, warning them about things that they might need to do something about right away. So there's a print version also, and you can find out on the same website how to subscribe to the print version. The print version has about 150,000 paid subscribers. The website is newer and has 8,000 or 9,000 subscribers. So we would like people to find out before the delayed, dangerously so, time that the FDA does something, what is really going on with the drug. Risks that you never heard about, in fact, in cases more recently, your doctor may have been told that this drug is safer than it really is. Something like 18,000 people went to Public Citizen's website to participate in a letter to the FDA saying, pull this thing back. It's a really lunatic kind of idea. So we are trying, and I think succeeding, in keeping up with the latest drugs that are approved. The FDA keeps approving drugs. They brag that they had one of the largest numbers of approvals last year. Some of these drugs were worthwhile, a few cancer drugs and things like that. But in addition, there were a number of drugs that should never have been approved, eventually will come off the market, but not before too many people take them. And I think if you read our website, worstpills.org, you will find the ones that we say do not use.
How do they subscribe, Sid, before we get onto our next subject with you?
They go to worstpills.org, and that you can get a electronic subscription there and find out how you can get a print subscription.
I have a quick question. What happens if your doctor prescribes a drug and you say, I don't want this drug? Sometimes they'll say, well, your insurance doesn't cover that drug. You have to take this drug. What happens if they won't prescribe the drug that you want?
Well, it's an interesting question. A large proportion of what we call, in the title of the book and newsletter, best pills are older drugs. Older drugs, by definition, are generally safer. The reason they're safer is that they have outlived the time when they would be taken off the market. They have outlived, for the most part, the time when there would be some new warning that was either unrevealed or unknown at the time they came on the market. So a lot of the drugs that we say, use these, don't use these, the don't use these, most of them are fairly recently prescribed drugs. In fact, we tell people in one of our 10 rules for safer drug use, which is right online, you don't even have to subscribe for that. One of them is, don't use any new drug for 7 years until after it's approved, unless it's a breakthrough drug. Very, very few drugs are breakthrough drugs. I would say 1 out of 10 at the most. And if it isn't one of those 10, it's a drug for which there are safer alternatives, equally effective alternatives, and just don't use them. Don't become a guinea pig during the first 7 years after a drug is on the market, because it's during those 7 years that a large proportion of the drugs that will be taken off the market or have new warnings get those warnings or bans.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Dr. Sidney Wolfe, Director of Public Citizens Health Research Group. And I want to now turn, Sid, in about 8 or 9 minutes we have left, to a report that you and Dr. Gagnon released on July 23rd. This one is a real stunner. And when you listen to this, our good audience, this is a perfect time for you to write to your member of Congress and ask him why people in the United States pay so much more for the exact same drug as people in dozens of other countries, not just Western countries. Your report is called Mirror, Mirror on the Wall. Medicare Part D pays needlessly high brand drug prices compared with other OECD countries, that's mostly European countries, and compared with other U.S. government programs like the Veterans Administration. Can you explain what Medicare Part D is for people who don't know? And the main thesis of your stunning report. You should see the graphs in this report and where they can see it online.
Okay, Medicare Part D is a program that's about 9 years old, and it was passed to provide drug benefits for Medicare recipients who didn't get them through Medicare Plus. I mean, Medicare to the extent that it covers older people, is a good program. It's been privatized too much. And Medicare Part D, now 9 years old, is completely privatized. Instead of the government collecting some money and providing at lower price the drugs, it farmed it out to 20 or 30 prescription drug insurance companies, is the best way of calling them. And what our study showed, and you can get, I'll tell you now how to get the study, just go to citizen.org/HRG publications. citizen.org/HRG for Health Research Group publications. And it's the first thing that will show up because it was just published a couple of weeks ago. Anyway, what we did is, to start out with, we got data that's not been made public yet, looking for a basket of 640 different drugs, exactly what the prices are in all the 31 OECD countries, which are Canada, the United States, and, as Ralph said, mostly Europe. And the prices here are way higher than any other country. The second largest is Canada, because Canada has an excellent single-payer healthcare system. In some of the provinces, they pay for drugs, and others, they don't. But the prices are way higher here even than in Canada, and in both countries, much higher than in Europe. Why? Because in Europe, they believe healthcare is a right. Everyone has healthcare. And in most of these countries, 100% of the people are covered by public drug plans, and the government can negotiate. They can say, you want to sell drugs in France or whatever, you have to deal with us. That's not the case here. So aside from the big discrepancy between what people pay or what the governments pay in those countries in Europe, within this country, we calculated that Medicare Part D, three-quarters of it comes out of the taxpayers, and a quarter comes from premiums from older people, many of whom don't have enough money to fill the prescriptions that the doctor writes for them because the prices are so high. We calculated that Medicare Part D could save $16 billion a year, not by going to the prices in Europe, but to have the savings that are obtained by the VA on one hand or Medicaid on the other hand. The VA bargains very hard and gets discounts. Medicaid itself gets what they call rebates. But in either case, and there it's about the same, it's a little more with the VA, they save $16 billion a year. This would mean a huge amount to many Medicare Part D recipients. For example, 16% of the Medicare Part D diabetics couldn't afford to fill their prescriptions. Why is that? It's because the government has given away the right to control drug prices. The law that passed, much to the delight, happiness, glee of the pharmaceutical industry, said the government is not allowed to negotiate with the drug industry for prices under Medicare Part D. These private drug insurance companies are, but they don't do as good a job as the Veterans Administration does. They don't do as good a job as even Medicaid does. So the program is a disaster, and the reason we did this report was to encourage people in the Congress to introduce legislation that would reverse the worst parts of Medicare Part D and allow the government to start controlling prices. If they did, more people who are sick who need prescriptions filled would be able to fill them, as opposed to turning away and saying it's that or food or something like that. So this is an example of the success of the largest lobby in the United States, the pharmaceutical lobby. It used to be the tobacco lobby. Tobacco has been beaten up by the pharmaceutical. They get their way in Washington. They get their way by passing legislation that allows them to fund the FDA. They get their way by disallowing the government to control prices for Medicare Part D. And in addition, President Obama, in order to get the what we call the Unaffordable Care Act passed, he promised the drug industry that for other drugs in this country, they would not try to control prices. So prices are out of control in this country. At least two parts of the government, Medicaid and the VA, have done something about it. But Medicare Part D, which is the largest prescription drug program in the country, larger than the DOD, larger than the VA, larger than Medicaid, it's the one that doesn't have the ability legally to control prices from the government's perspective. So again, if you want to see our report, it's citizen.org/HRG publications. That's the first publication to show up. And as we said before, people who are concerned, as we all should be, about the lack of safety of too many drugs on the market can find out about it at worstpills, one word, worstpills.org.
Before I ask you, Sid, just to spell out what a simple letter or email to the senators and representatives by folks who are listening to this program demanding what should be done by Congress on this huge disparity between drug prices here compared to France, Germany, Norway, Luxembourg, Iceland, etc.
And more importantly, between VA and Medicaid.
Right.
People should write their senator and congressman and urge them to introduce legislation that will allow the government to control prices on prescription drugs that are used by Medicare recipients, Medicare Part D. The prices are out of control. The Congress has the ability to do something about it, and you need to urge your Congress people, senators, representatives, to do something about it.
You know, in closing, Sid, I find the giant drug companies arrogant beyond belief. They are subsidized by the U.S. government. They're called research and development tax credits, like they get checks from the U.S. Treasury, huge amounts. They're given free research and development that you, the taxpayer, pay, developed by the National Institutes of Health and their contractors. And they buy from China and India about 80% of the ingredients that are in medicines that you take in the United States, meaning they're exporting jobs and not allowing sufficient surveillance of these labs in China and India. And what's their gratitude to the American people? They charge them the highest prices of anyone in the world, because in other countries they can't get away with it, but in the U.S. they can. So I want to thank you very much, Dr. Sidney Wolf, Director of the Public Citizen Health Research Group, for the information. So send an email or a letter to your member of Congress and tap into this very, very protective database that Sid has described for you. Once more, Sid, can you give him the website?
It's Worst Pills, just one word, worstpills.org. And you will see a lot of information there that will be useful. We hear from people who say, I read this, my doctor prescribed it, I took the article to my doctor. Some of the doctors are too arrogant and they say, well, whatever. But other doctors, we get letters from people saying, my doctor said, I didn't know about this. Let's consider switching you to another drug. That's a good doctor. Nice talking to you again.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sidney Wolf.
We've been talking to Dr. Sidney Wolf, whose book and online newsletter, Worst Pills, Best Pills, is the definitive guide to the safety and effectiveness of the drugs on the market. Just what I've learned from this show, if you are taking Crestor for high cholesterol,
yeah,
Celebrex for pain relief, or Vandia for diabetes, get off of them and go to worstpills.org for more information on a particular drug you may be taking that also has that black box warning. We also talked about his new report, co-authored out of the Public Citizen Health Research Group, entitled Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, about how Medicare Plan D is paying needlessly high prices for name brand drugs, another privatization issue. For more information on that, go to citizen.org.
I have a question for Ralph that I think the doctor didn't quite answer. What happens if I say to my doctor, I don't want this pill, and he insists that your insurance only covers the specific pill?
The insurance is more likely to cover generic drugs as opposed to brand name drugs. It's a good insurance plan. They will say, this generic drug has been around for a long time. We know that it's effective and it's safer. And insurance companies should be preferentially, if there is an equally effective and or safer drug on the market, going for those. The most expensive drugs are often the ones that are the worst pills, particularly because they are still on patent. There's no generic version of them at all. So, you know, doctors may say something like that, but I think that if you look at the majority of what we call the better or best pills in the book, those in probably 2/3, 3/4 of cases are available generically.
And cheaper.
Less expensive.
Cheaper, yeah. Thanks very much, Sid.
Okay. Good question.
Good. Thanks, Sid.
Thanks, Sid. Now that you've been on twice, we can now, I guess, consider you a friend of the show. Next, we're going to be talking to journalist and author Alyssa Katz about the power of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce right after we hear from our corporate crime reporter, Russell McIver. Russell?
From the National Press Building in Washington, D.C., this is your Corporate Crime Reporter Morning Minute for Wednesday, August 5, 2015. I'm Russell Mokhiber. In a landmark ruling issued yesterday, an Idaho federal court struck down the state's so-called ad gag law. Under the law, journalists, workers, activists, and members of the public can be convicted of a crime for videotaping animal cruelty or life-threatening safety violations. The court held that the law has the effect of suppressing speech on topics of immense public importance, including the safety of the food supply and the safety of farm workers and animals. The court held that protecting the private interests of a powerful industry which produces the public's food supply against public scrutiny is not a legitimate government interest. For the Corporate Crime Reporter, I'm Russell Mokhiber.
Thank you, Russell. Remember to subscribe to this program for free on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you've missed any of this episode on the radio, go to our website, RalphNaderRadioHour.com, and catch up on what you've missed on this or any of our other 72 programs, which are archived there. And while you're there, click on the link that will take you to Ralph's latest book, Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President, 2001 to 2015. David?
Our next guest comes to us from New York City, where she is a prolific writer. She specializes in covering urban policy, politics, and housing. Her name is Alyssa Katz of the New York Daily News. Ms. Katz has also written for the American Prospect, The Big Money, Salon, Housing Watch, Mother Jones, The Next American City, among many others. Ms. Katz has also worked with the Pratt Center for Community Development, an organization that helps community-based organizations in New York City's lower and moderate income communities influence city planning and development. Her latest book is what we're going to talk about today. It's entitled The Influence Machine, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the Corporate Capture of American Life. On this program, we like to refer to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce as the Death Star. Welcome, Alyssa Katz.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being on, Alyssa Katz. Your book is titled The Influence Machine, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Corporate Capture of American Life by Spiegel and Grau, just out. And I'm holding it in my hand right now. And I want to set the frame for our discussion with a story that happened about 3 years ago and stunned even the cynics in Washington. About 3 years ago, President Obama walked out of the front door of his White House across Lafayette Square, another street across, to pay homage to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce building, which is nearby the AFL-CIO Labor Federation building. We were right on the corner because it was a well-publicized meeting weeks ahead of time that Barack Obama was going to come over and meet with his worst political enemies who've been trying to defeat him in Congress and defeat him and his associates on election time. Let me ask you this. Why would a president of the United States humble himself and walk across Lafayette Park to pay homage to the Chamber of Commerce when he wouldn't even go around the corner to visit the AFL-CIO Trade Union Federation, who was responsible for his election more than any other group?
That is a great question. And of course, I cannot see inside the president's mind, but I will take my best and not too difficult guess, which is simply that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has a vice grip on Congress. And at the time, it had elected the Republican majority in the House and would soon help ensure a Republican majority in the Senate, and specifically a majority that could be counted on reliably to advance the interest of a relatively small number of well-entrenched, wealthy companies that sought to protect their position within the American economy. So since then, President Obama has gone on to very aggressively and necessarily use executive power to accomplish his agenda as best he can. You know, at the time, he could still hold out hope that there was an opportunity there to work with Congress and that these were actually reasonable actors who wanted to collaborate in order to achieve the best outcomes for the American people. So the president went and dealt with them, and the chamber has a power that is far, far surpassed what was once a fairly strong power of the AFL-CIO and of labor, which not very long ago in history had a much stronger base of support in Congress and could really be heard in Washington.
Let me ask you this, Alyssa. The interesting thing about the Chamber of Commerce, on the front of their building, they have a big sign that basically says they're for more jobs. Yet they've supported every corporate-managed trade agreement, NAFTA, WTO, World Trade Organization, and this Trans-Pacific Agreement, which has resulted in the export of millions of jobs to China, Malaysia, Vietnam, Mexico, as well as whole industries that have hollowed out our economy. Again, they're against union organizing. They block labor law reform that might facilitate tens of millions of Americans who've wanted to join unions, like people working for Walmart or Target or McDonald's. They are opposed to even the restoration of the minimum wage, which is way below what it should be, inflation adjusted. It's now federally $7.25 per hour, and it would be $11 per hour if it was just adjusted for inflation from 1968. And to top it off, and this will set up my question, on page 228 of your marvelous book, I think it's the first muckraking book on the Chamber of Commerce that I've seen in a long time, you say that the Chamber is even against Buy America rules. That is, while China throws, in your words, quote, a blanket of protectionism around its own economy, end quote, Mr. Donahue, who's the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, is basically against buying America. By buying America, it means that when the U.S. government or state and federal and local governments, they buy things, they have to buy billions and billions of dollars. They buy energy, they buy construction materials, they buy health care, they buy all kinds of things, housing. He's against these government procurement agencies in the federal government and the state saying we want to give preference to America. Here's the key question. How unpatriotic do you think the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is? And how many companies have been so turned off by the Chamber of Commerce that they've quit it? Stop being members, if you want to describe that. First, the patriotism issue.
Right. You know, I think that's a really fundamental question you're asking, because getting back to that jobs banner or the banners on the front of the Chamber of Commerce building, they never say where those jobs are or for whom or what kind of jobs those actually are. And the Chamber has, to a remarkable degree that I talk about at some length in my book, really encouraged and supported the outsourcing of what have been American jobs around the world to cheaper markets, less regulated markets, where the labor force is not only cheaper, but more often more pliable, where environmental regulations are much laxer, where a whole host of regulatory ground rules that we as Americans understand are necessary for just the basic functioning of an economy, for a healthy society, to preserve the earth, all the things that our Congress and the people think are important, that we're perfectly comfortable taking those jobs, sending them to other parts of the world where those constraints do not apply. And increasingly what you see is that the core membership of the Chamber of Commerce, the members who appear to contribute the most money, although donors are generally secret, but what you see is a lot of multinational companies that are really looking to create an environment that allows for a race to the bottom for wages, for environmental regulations, where U.S. companies can operate within the least restrictive environment possible, whatever those consequences, and that this, the chamber then advocates for those policies as necessary and essential for the functioning of the American economy. And will often kind of use scare tactics on Congress, on regulators, and others who would get in the way, saying, well, if you do this, you know, if you regulate in this way, if you discourage outsourcing of jobs, if you repatriate tax money parked overseas by taxing it, whatever the policy intervention may be, they will scare folks in Washington into thinking that they will kill the economy and kill jobs if they would dare to do such a thing. And so, yes, I mean, your question about patriotism, it is what you see is the chamber and its leading members really subverting the national interest in many ways in order to advance its own members' global ambitions and global business models at the expense of American communities, at the health of American society, in ways that are pretty consistently destructive. So, you know, you're asking about companies that are, you know, beginning to kind of get wise to what's going on here. I mean, I think we've seen a couple of remarkable cycles now. We may see more of chamber members kind of caught in the squeeze between the kind of public face of the chamber, where, you know, I think in the popular imagination, the Chamber of Commerce is a kind of all-American business group that is looking out for the best interests of companies and the economy and the American venture to make sure that the nation is strong. What they have begun to see is how much this organization has in recent years really become subject to very specific agendas of some of its bigger donors who have very particular kind of political needs that they exercise through the chamber.
Like the oil companies and climate change. Isn't that what led to one burst of companies just quitting? Didn't Apple quit? Didn't, name some companies who quit the chamber.
Sure, sure. So, no, Apple quit the chamber. So, I was just to set the stage here. What you had in 2008, 2009, as we had a real chance in Congress to get a cap and trade program, a market based, very capitalistic program to incentivize reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, really critical program that had already proven itself in, on a smaller scale in various parts of the country. What you had is interest from the coal industry, other interests, we don't know who they are because the chamber's donors are secret, contributing large sums to the chamber, and then the chamber in turn advocating very aggressively first against cap and trade, and they belatedly came around to wanting to make a deal, but too little too late, and then absurdly fighting and continuing to fight the Environmental Protection Agency's effort to pass regulations that it's obligated to put out there under the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gases as a pollutant. And the chamber absurdly claimed that climate change is not a threat to human health or life, or that it had not yet been proven. And therefore, the EPA did not have the authority to act. So what you had is companies, and these included Apple and Nike, had been a member of the chamber board of directors, stayed with the chamber but left the chamber board. You had a number of energy companies as well, such as Duke Energy, that had to explain to their shareholders, had to explain to consumers and the American public, yes, I know we said we had this green policy and that we're committed to greenhouse gas reduction as a company, but yes, we're also members of this Chamber of Commerce that is determined to prevent anything from being done in Washington on this. And those companies simply could not retain their membership or remain on the chamber board, you know, under those circumstances. So the chamber, it was quite embarrassing for the chamber. They lost some key members over, you know, in the initial climate fight in Washington. And more recently, we've seen the same cycle happen with new revelations, and I have others in my book as well, about tobacco companies, you know, spending large amounts of money to effectively hire the Chamber of Commerce as a front group to kind of greenwash this deadly industry, where if, of course, it had been the tobacco companies going to Washington, or in a more recent example, going internationally and using a WTO trade tribunal to try to absurdly block very basic measures in Australia, of all places, to discourage smoking. In this instance, the chamber found a friendly host in the Ukraine and then got the Ukraine to sue Australia and attempt to block tobacco packaging to discourage smoking there. So the chamber is able to go out there and say, oh, we are fighting these regulations to curb smoking on behalf of all business, because this is bad for business. It's bad for the Ukraine, or it's bad for the American economy. Wherever they are attempting to lobby or litigate on behalf of the tobacco industry, the chamber can plausibly say, because its donors are secret, oh, well, we're just doing this because it's good for business. And if the principle of regulating in this manner is anathema and cannot stand. Whereas, of course, the tobacco companies, were they out there doing it themselves, would be laughed out of the courtroom, laughed out of Congress, because nobody, no judge or official would be able to stand up and explain to constituents, oh yeah, we just did this thing to help these companies that are killing people.
One of the ways the U.S. Chamber of Commerce influences government, it's the architect of the corporate state. What the conservatives call crony capitalism, because they always go for more corporate welfare, subsidies, handouts, giveaways. Somehow that escapes the definition of capitalism, which is supposed to sink or swim on the market on its merits or demerits. So it isn't that the Chamber of Commerce doesn't like big government. This isn't like health and safety regulation that protects people, but it loves the big government of luscious contracts and cost overruns and, of course, all kinds of tax escapes. But the thing that I found about the Chamber, two things. One is they work with K Street lobbyists to put their own people in government, put their own people on congressional staff, put their own people in government departments and agencies. But the astonishing thing, Alyssa, is how little the Chamber of Commerce is investigated by the Washington Press Corps. Now, I know that the Chamber did not cooperate with you, did not give you the kind of interviews you wanted. But when you wrote this book, The Influence Machine, and by the way, listeners, this is a very clearly written book. Alyssa writes for the New York Daily News. They don't use big, obscure words and phrases. This is very clearly written. Why do you think the Chamber of Commerce, because people know what it does in Washington media circles, why does it escape the kind of critical, boring, B-O-R-I-N-G, investigative reporting? And they're also against access to the courts and against remedies for wrongfully injured people. They're for the tort reform movement. Why do you think they escape?
I think, and I say this as a member, I'm always grateful of the New York Press Corps more than I am of the Washington Press Corps. I mean, I think there's a tendency in, you know, in media to kind of travel with the pack and also kind of defer to conventional authority and wisdom, in part out of a desire to cultivate access to sources, in part for fear of being labeled as non-objective, right? If you were to dare say that the emperor has no clothes and that, in fact, numerous members of Congress are kind of bought and paid for either by the chamber or by other big money groups that have followed in its path and are also in ways that are borderline illegal, spending millions and millions of dollars on elections in order to secure friendly members of Congress, some of whom indeed had worked for the chamber, some, you know, or who have members of their staff, key members of their staff who work for the chamber. You have a lot of very, very close ties. You also have longstanding relationships between the leadership of both the House and Senate, between them and the chamber. So, you know, John Boehner in the House, the Speaker of the House, has been working since the 1990s, since the moment that current chamber CEO Tom Donohue showed up and decided they were going to be a, you know, lobbying powerhouse in Washington. And they are the biggest by spending by far, having spent over $1 billion on lobbying. Donohue very early on cultivated John Boehner and a few, I think Newt Gingrich and a few other members at that time as key allies. And they got to work trying to figure out how they can bolster, get more friendly members elected through spending that the Federal Election Commission investigated and where the staff recommended that they be sanctioned, that the chamber be sanctioned and Boehner and friends be sanctioned because they had colluded in ways that really weren't proper. So that relationship is longstanding. You also have close ties with Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, for, you know, just to take one example of those ties, and this is significant in light of President Obama's current effort to regulate greenhouse gases by reducing greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, which McConnell from Kentucky, a coal state, is fighting very, very aggressively. So McConnell's former chief of staff, Stephen Law, was the legal architect behind the chamber's policy, or I'm sorry, the chamber's strategy to spend millions and millions of dollars independently on helping elect friendly members of Congress and flip Democratic seats to pro-business Republicans around the country. Particularly the biggest year for this was 2010, but the strategy has been building for years. Stephen Law had been McConnell's chief of staff and worked for the chamber, went and devised a strategy, and is now leading the same election work for Karl Rove over at the American Crossroads Network.
This is a perfect example of the corporate state. We're running out of time, Alyssa. The chamber has a lot of local and state chamber of commerce, as they claim are members. I've met some of these people around the country. A lot of them don't like what the Chamber of Commerce stands for. What should people back home take away from your book, The Influence Machine, The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Corporate Capture of American Life? What should they take away from your book? in order to contact their local chamber of commerce and fight back. What do you tell citizens of this country they should do to reduce the influence of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce on the U.S. government?
Well, first of all, and I think this is largely a symbolic gesture, but an important one at this point, that people should contact their local chambers of commerce. And if those chambers are, in fact, members of the National Federation, some are and some are not, that they should say, they should really urge those local chambers to leave the U.S. chamber and function independently, as many, many chambers of commerce do. That is a largely symbolic gesture at this point, given that really the lion's share of the chamber's funding comes from a very small number of major corporate donors, and, you know, not only nominal sums come from the local chambers of commerce. I think the more important thing that individuals can do, and certainly if, you know, we're talking about small business owners, entrepreneurs who are fed up with how the chamber is operating on behalf of killer businesses, that they should look to, there are rising grassroots business organizations. You have the American Sustainable Business Council, Small Business Majority, and some other groups that are organizing businesses that want to see a different framework for how government approaches business and does not, you know, where they are really looking toward supporting the environment, supporting fair wages in ways that work for business, not, you know, putting themselves out of business, but also trying to figure out win-wins for both business and the American people.
Alyssa, give the names of those two groups again, and also tell people before we conclude, we're running out of time, how they can contact you.
Sure. So one really important group here is the American Sustainable Business Council. It's a national group with local chapters that supports double and triple bottom line businesses that support the environment, support fair wages and working conditions, but also want to, you know, make a profit and be successful businesses. You also have Small Business Majority, which similar membership group also does a lot of good policy work and some really revealing surveys that show what business owners actually think about economic policy. And the results couldn't be more different than the releases that one sees from the Chamber of Commerce about what businesses need and want.
I can attest to that. How do they get a hold of you, Alyssa?
Best way to reach me, you can email me at my New York Daily News email address, and that is akatz@nydailynews.com, or you can go to my website, alyssakatz.com, alyssakatz.com.
The pride of Brooklyn, New York, Alyssa Katz, the author of the brand new book, The Influence Machine, on the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Thank you very much, Alyssa Katz.
Thank you very much.
We have come to the end of the show, and I want to thank our guest today, the journalist Alyssa Katz, author of The Influence Machine, The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and The Corporate Capture of American Life, from publishers Spiegel and Graw. Go to RalphNaderRadio.com, and we'll post a link to make it easier for you to buy a copy. Also, follow Alyssa on Twitter at AllyKatz. That's AllyKatzz, two Zs. Also want to thank Dr. Sidney Wolf of Public Citizen. Go to citizen.org for his latest report on Medicare Plan D. And also go to worstpills.org for the online version of Worst Pills, Best Pills. Don't forget to pick up a copy of Ralph's book, Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President, 2001-2015. Go to native.org for Ralph's weekly blog. For more of Russell McKiber, go to corporatecrimereporter.com. And if you have missed any of this or any of our episodes, go to ralphnaderradiohour.com. Our producers, Jimmy Lee Wirt and Matthew Marin. On behalf of David Feldman, I'm Steve Scrovan. Talk to you next week, Ralph.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, David. And spread the word. Act, act. Spread the word, listeners.
Stand up, stand up. You've been sitting way too long.
In the temple, too much money changing hands. It's really very simple. Just make a list of demands. We demand freedom. We demand equality. We demand justice. It ain't gonna happen until folks like you and me just stand up. Well, you've been sitting way too long.
Oh, step up.
You know what's right and you know what's wrong.
Rise up.
Don't let the system.